this is Jen Rubin, and this is Jen Rubin's Green Room. Isn't it fun now to talk about the news? It's not all drudgery. It's not fear. You don't have to watch the candidate of your choice, who is not Donald Trump, I am assuming, with one eye squinted and your ears practically closed. No, it's a joy to watch politics, and it's a joy to watch politics done well. And that's what strikes me about the Kamala Harris campaign. In just over a week, they have gone out on social media. They have whipped up enthusiasm. They have raised hundreds of millions of dollars. They have put together these calls, the last one being the White Dudes call. They have really, I think, tapped into a hunger among not just Democrats, but independents for someone other than two old guys as candidates. And I think she has been able to free herself from the constriction of being vice president. She can say what she wants. She can say it in the way she wants. And I think she's shown real flair, real zeal and joy in the campaign, as well she should. After all, this is an opportunity for a bipartisan, multi-ideological, multiracial, multi-religious coalition of Americans. And we shouldn't diminish the opportunity we have to create something that is not only not Donald Trump, but that's something better. We spend a lot of time talking about the dangers to American democracy. And to be sure, Project 2025 is a real menace. Trump is a menace. But there's also a lot of positive things that could come out of this campaign. And I think we're just beginning to see it. We're seeing a very positive affirmation of freedom as a critical theme for Democrats. It's a theme that Republicans have absconded with for years. We're seeing a reaffirmation of inclusiveness, that it's not cool to denigrate women. It's not cool to denigrate people without children. We are also seeing, I think, a better restatement of the achievements of the past 4 years than we were able to perhaps get from President Biden. We're hearing more about the economic success, the success in beating crime, in reducing border crossings. So there's a lot to be very happy about. There's a lot to be cheery about. And perhaps the most fun is watching all of these vice presidential contenders kind of audition on television, on podcasts, all over the place. And I got to say, Democrats are very fortunate. They have a very deep bench. Someone asked me the other day who I prefer. And the answer is, they're all good. I really don't have a favorite. They all come with certain strengths. There are certain weaknesses, as any candidate does. If you, for example, choose Josh Shapiro, who I like very much, you're then opening up the governorship of Pennsylvania. If you choose Mark Kelly, you're opening up a Senate seat in the swing state of Arizona. So there's no perfect choice. But what all of these guys are doing, and frankly, they're all guys, is, I think, kind of the Clinton-Gore phenomenon. And that is, they are amplifying the message. They are reinforcing her relative youth, her enthusiasm, her take no prisoners kind of campaigning, the reaffirmation of shared values, the reaffirmation that we have a democracy to defend. And so I think the pairing, whoever it is, will help reinforce the Kamala Harris message. And perhaps by this time next week, we'll know exactly who that person is. And word comes that she will go out on the campaign trail with that person. And that in turn will, I think, lead to another burst of excitement. Now, in the meantime, President Biden unveiled his Supreme Court reform package. This is something many of us had been begging him to do for a few years. So in this case, it really is better late than never. We do need a constitutional amendment given the Supreme Court that says, no, the president does have to obey the law. We thought that was self-evident, but perhaps we do need a constitutional amendment. We should have a mandatory ethics code. After the absolute greed, the monstrous corruption that we have seen from at least two justices, it's time to have a firm, clear, code of ethics, the same code that every other judge in the federal bench must abide by, and some outside supervision. And lastly, it's more than time to have term limits. Frankly, I don't think the founders ever envisioned putting 30-year-olds or 35-year-olds or even 40-year-olds on the court and having them last for 50 years. The dead weight of history is sometimes just too much. And I think if we have term limits and they are equally distributed over every president's term, we frankly will not have this phenomenon of a hyper-ideological appointment process and then confirmation process. The stakes will perhaps be lowered. So that's a positive thing. Kamala Harris has embraced that. And again, we have the promise perhaps of a presidency that is not mired in corruption, but that has the potential for reform and improvement of our democracy. Boy, wouldn't that be something. I know what is in all of your minds, and that is, how do we keep fascism at the door and not let them into the house? That's what we're facing in November. That's what we're up against. We're up against a giant propaganda machine, a right-wing movement that has its followers in really a cult of personality and seemingly unreachable by reason, by facts. So I was minding my own business, reading a lot of history like I usually do, and I came across a book, How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler, by a gentleman by the name of Peter Pomperantsev. And I thought, wow, that would kind of be helpful to learn about. And sure enough, it tells the story of a Brit who spent some of his early years in Germany, came back to Britain, and then devised the most ingenious propaganda campaign, creative, innovative, counterintuitive in a lot of ways, that helped combat the Nazi propaganda machine. And it's a fabulous story. It's entertaining, and it obviously has lessons for us today. So I'm so thrilled that we have Peter with us. Peter, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure. This character, Sefton Delmer, I've read a lot about World War II, and I've never heard of him before I read your book. How did you figure out who he was?
Well, look, I study contemporary disinformation. I write books about it. I research ways to fight it at Johns Hopkins University. So it's something that I specialize on, and people started turning up to events that I did and started saying, have you heard of how our side practiced disinformation in World War II? And maybe we need to do it again. And Sefton Delmer was actually a famous person in the mid-20th century. He was probably the most famous sort of foreign correspondent in Britain. He wrote his memoirs in the 60s. They sold very well. He was on TV a lot, on the BBC. So he was well known, but you know, like many journalists, his fame faded. There's a reason the word journalism comes from the word un jour, a day. It's a profession, and both of us are kind of part of it in some way, where your legend fades very fast. And so he you know, people had forgotten about him. But when I started to read his memoirs about his work in the Second World War, where he worked not as a journalist, but as what he himself described as a propagandist of the dark arts of subterfuge and subversion and disinformation to subvert the Nazis, I couldn't get enough of his storytelling.
He is a fascinating character. He was born in Britain, and he spent a great deal of time in Germany. But as you outline, he always felt like a bit of a misfit. He was never all one thing or all the other, and perhaps his own identity at times got a bit confused, which made him almost a perfect personality to do what essentially became an impersonation activity as he engaged in counter-propaganda. Give us a sense, for those who have not yet read the book, what it was that he latched onto. What did he understand about German propaganda and what that necessitated in terms of a response?
So firstly, he was actually, even though his background was British, he was born in Germany. He spent his childhood in Germany. He then went back to study in Britain and then went to Germany in the 20s and 30s and became probably the most famous British journalist covering the rise of the Nazis. He got to know the Nazis intimately when they still were just a rising political force. He got to go backstage on Hitler's famous air tours when he was flying around Germany, inspiring crowds in a very important election in 1928, where Hitler was this sort of magnetic force, rabble-rousing crowds, bringing them to levels of kind of like hysterical hatred, while his rival was this old-timer, Hindenburg, who was this guy, this legend of German politics, but who was so old and decrepit, he could barely make a public speech anymore. And any comparisons I'm making with today's situation are accidental. So, Delmas saw that the power of Nazi propaganda lay, firstly, it's in its emotional power. Secondly, the way it sort of constructed an identity for people who were really, really lost and confused in a new world of new technology, a new society, an urbanizing world, a world where even old gender identities were being questioned. The Nazis kind of gave you a role to play where you knew who you were. You were part of, you know, a unique and superior ethnic group. You were an Aryan. You were a pure German. And you knew who you were. You know, you were a party member. You were a member of the Stormtroopers. You were a member of the Hitlerjugend. Delmer had basically a very theatrical view of human nature, that people need roles to play. And what nasty propaganda does, it gives you roles to play where you know who you are, where you get to be part of a group, where you get to relinquish responsibility, which Delmer felt a lot of people yearn for. And here was the thing, where you got to indulge in your nastiest and most horrible urges and desires. He had a slightly bleak view of human nature. He basically thought people knew perfectly well what they were doing when they were indulging in the hysterical theater of Nazism. He didn't think people were brainwashed. He thought people were willing actors in a theater of cruelty. So that meant that things like...
And it was also this duality that there was a acceptance that Germany had been defeated. It was an inferiority. But at the same time, you could use that and the disgrace of Germany as an excuse to become the oppressor yourself, to enact revenge, to explain away the past failings. So it is this peculiar mix of constant fear that some great conspiracy, in that case the Jews, were going to overtake you, which in turn justifies your being the oppressor. So it was a kind of a strange inferiority-superiority complex that was also at work here, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's one that I've seen, you know, in my study of contemporary propaganda. You see it over and over and over again. It's what Putin plays on, it's what Milosevic plays on. I'll let the listeners make their own kind of, you know, conclusions about what's going on in America. But look, it's one of the oldest propaganda tricks in the book, and it always works, you know. You take your audience, your crowd on a kind of journey from feeling very humiliated, you know, everybody's put us down. And look, we all feel put down by someone. Sometimes there's some historical, you know, reasons for that. Sometimes we just feel put down because we feel bad about ourselves. It's not hard to tell people others have been putting you down. That taps into like the victim in each of us. And then you take them on a journey where at the start of a speech, you know, they feel humiliated, and take them on a journey where by the end of it, they're the ones doing the humiliating. And again, it almost serves as an excuse because we've been humiliated, we may humiliate others. You know, so if you take them on a journey from we've been humiliated, let us learn empathy. You know, you could go on that journey. That's not where you're going with this. And look, I think when we hear somebody like Putin, somebody Duterte or Xi Jinping in China, talking about humiliation, we have to be very, very careful. These are very, very powerful people who have immense might. You know, these are not the downtrodden of the earth. And when bullies are talking about how they were once humiliated, what they're really saying is, this is what I'm going to do to others. And again, Delmer would say that this is what a lot of people yearn for. I mean, again, Delmer, I think, pushed back a little bit against this idea that people are brainwashed, that they're brainwashed, that they're, you know, poor, yes, vulnerable victims of propaganda. He's saying, no, what propaganda does is enable and legitimize and normalize all the nasty things that people want to do. And so, you know, when it came to counter-propaganda, Delmer was very opposed to things like the German service of the BBC or to lots of liberal exiled German media that was preaching to people, that was saying, you know, essentially preaching the virtues of democracy, trying to teach people how evil fascism was and how, you know, how they should turn to the light of liberalism. And he basically thought this was, you know, liberal Germans supported by the British, stuck in their own, what we would call today, echo chamber, you know, talking to themselves, preaching to the converted, and really understanding nothing about this deep, dark, emotional bond between Nazi propaganda and Germans. And his mission was to start disrupting that bond, to start breaking it open. And that meant going to some very dark and unpleasant places.
And what he, I think, latched onto, which I think is so important in any common context, is that you have to not only realize that they are playing a role, but seize on their delight in doing something a little irreverent, a little forbidden, not too forbidden. They don't want to be, you know, preached to, but they want to feel like they're doing something a little clever or doing something that's not completely verboten, to borrow a phrase. So what did he devise? What was the kind of propaganda show that he put on for the Germans?
So Delmer basically ended up running sort of dozens of radio stations broadcasting across occupied Europe. It was kind of an empire of subversive, I'd like to call it counter-propaganda, but he was quite comfortable calling it propaganda. So subversive propaganda, which included, you know, hundreds of people working out of this very, very beautiful country estate, Woburn Abbey, outside of London. And he recruited amazing people to work with him. So psychiatrists, lots of cabaret artists from the German cabaret scene who were in exile, who he came to work on his shows, scholars, novelists. Ian Fleming, the author of James Bond, helped organize this whole thing. And it was, at the end of the day, it was some dozens of radio stations and newspapers and leaflets and a whole empire of subversive propaganda. But it started with one show. And it was kind of, in many ways, the most famous one, something called Der Chef. Basically, it was fronted by a right-wing, really racist and really rather vile German officer who was spewing these invectives against Nazi officials. Not Hitler. He wouldn't touch Hitler. Hitler was too popular. But definitely against Goering, Goebbels, that lot. But then against mid-ranking Nazi officials, you know, the vice mayor of Cologne or something. And basically revealing these incredible secrets about their corruption, about their sexual perversity. There was a lot of pornography, a lot of really, really graphic pornography, yes, lots of sort of orgy scenes of corrupt Nazi officials smearing themselves in cake and butter with ladies of the night and sailors and helmets and all sorts of objects. And look, the first thing that Delmer was trying to do with this show, which was amazingly popular inside of Germany in 1941, at the very peak of Hitler's power, was to kind of break a taboo, break what communication scholars call a spiral of silence. He was saying the unsayable. You know, there's great letters from Eric Kästner, who's probably the most famous children's author in Germany, saying everybody in Berlin is listening to this radio stations, and the things they say are just unimaginable. So you're breaking a taboo. He also did something very clever. This wasn't a show lecturing people. This was a show which was actually sounded like their chef talking to a secret cabal of soldiers, saying, you know, kind of coded messages in little 15-minute bursts. So people had the sense they were spying onto, listening into a secret conversation. So, you know, he was awakening curiosity. Even the genre was awakening curiosity. Breaking taboos. I mean, the pornography was there to reel viewers in. It nearly got Delmer banned because when bits of the British government that were a bit prudish found out about these shows, they basically tried to have them banned. And famously, one of them said, if this is the way we're going to win the war, I'd rather we lose it. And there was a huge attempt to ban them within the government itself, which in the end was staved off because of its effectiveness. I mean, there was feedback that the British were getting from their various spies inside occupied Germany that was making quite crazy claims, I think, that this was the most popular station in Germany. I think that's what we would call a qualitative rather than a quantitative piece of analysis. But people were saying that. And so you don't stop that if it's going so well. And it was, you know, there was a very clear aim. He was trying to sow a division between Nazi officials, the Nazi party, and the army. Yeah. He was trying to sort of, not just to soldiers, you know, ordinary people were meant to think, oh my God, there's actually problems in this system which at that moment ruled Europe from, you know, the Atlantic French coast to the Black Sea. Yeah, this is before the invasion of the Soviet Union. This is at a moment when Britain might fall. So that's the first one that Delmer does, breaking taboos. But also, you've got to understand, already he's doing something that's going to become his hallmark. Though, even though the facade of the show was fake, this was not actually being fronted by a far-right German officer. The show was being fronted by a mild-mannered German Jewish refugee. Who wrote rather whimsical romantic novels when he wasn't doing this sort of thing. It was already stuffed full of really good research. So the stories about corruption were as true as Delmer could make them. And they were garnered by partisans inside occupied Europe, giving the latest rumors that they'd hear kind of at bars and bordellos in Calais. It was fed with sort of details of how the Nazi officials were living the high life, by opening their letters as they sent them to relatives in America, for example. So he was already launching this huge information gathering operation with the aim of sort of telling Germans, look, we know more about your lives. This station is more about your lives than Nazi officials. Then, but no, that's the stuff I read about first when I started exploring Delmer's career. A little bit's in his memoirs. A lot has now been declassified. The British Archive, which explains their plans and the day-to-day running, has been declassified really over the 1990s. And then the real kind of delicious bit for me was when I realized that we have the transcripts of the shows, because the nice American monitors of Nazi radio at the State Department thought this was a real Nazi station and were making transcriptions of the shows. So over in College Park, you have the transcription. So I could read the shows, and that was delicious. But there was a moment when I decided that I wanted to write a book about it. And that was actually, as I read into the story, it turned out that from 1943, and it took me a while for me to get my head around this, Delmer wanted his listeners to know that this was the British imitating the Nazis. And when I read that, I was like, what? Because up till now, it just sounded like a very, very kind of well-made version of what Russia is trying to do to America all the time. You know, when the Russians create fake Twitter accounts pretending to be Americans to poison the debate in America. You know, it was a nasty tactic that Delmer was using, though in his case, I think for a good cause. But from 1943, he says he wants Germans to know that this is the British dressed up as Nazis. And I was like, okay, this is actually something completely different. Because if he's doing that, it's not even deception. It's some sort of weird masquerade that he wants the listener to be involved in. And I started reading up other people who were there. So that's when I started going around doing the sort of journalist historian thing, finding, you know, who else was there, and found quite a lot of unpublished memoirs of other people there. And they all write about this. They all say this. We weren't trying to deceive Germans. Quite the opposite. We wanted them to know that we know more about your lives than Nazi propaganda. We wanted them to know that we can imitate Nazi style and German style broadcasts to such an effective way. It makes people question, like, hold on, if the British can be German, then maybe being German isn't something that the Nazis control. Maybe there's a different kind of way of being German. It's a very subtle psychological process they were trying to nudge people towards, where people would start to question this collective identity that the Nazis were claiming only they could provide. Also, they wanted to provide a safe space. You know, if you were caught by the Gestapo listening to these stations, you go, well, sir, I thought this was a German soldier broadcasting this. I had no idea this was the British. So they were also giving people an excuse. And they write about this a lot, a psychological excuse. They basically worked out that it was easier for people to listen to criticism of the Nazis if you were saying, our boys, we Germans, even though you knew perfectly well it was the British saying it. The fact that it was placed inside that language made it easier for people to, at the end of the day, you know, betray their own country, which is what they were doing. And as Delmer's empire of radios grew, and they grew way beyond the single kind of subversive German officer, there was, you know, a vast armed forces radio that he was creating, which, according to the British polls, they were doing little polls of German POWs, around 40% of German soldiers were listening to. You know, that was the game Delmer was trying to bring people into. And when I realized that he was doing something incredibly sophisticated, it's like inviting people to a masquerade where you can all dress up in order to say what you really think about Hitler, because it was full by that time of criticism of Hitler. Then I was like, wow, there is something really sophisticated happening here. And that's when I was like, okay, I think I want to write a book about it. Because I think that kind of puts it in a different space. I mean, when I started researching Delmer, I was thinking, he is our guy who did subversive disinformation. And then I realized he was doing something much more interesting.
What kind of made it all sing, of course, was a certain authenticity, that he was able to get such specific, detailed information from POWs, from other sources of information, and feed that back to them, that this was more accurate and they knew it was more accurate than what they were getting. And so part of this seemed to have been an effort to raise questions about them, about what is true? What are we being told is true? Maybe it's not the truth. Maybe these other people have the truth. So it was beginning to essentially break this kind of collaborative sense of belonging, because if they're lying to me, then I don't belong to them. Maybe I better listen to these people. So it became this very deft, you know, kind of psychological game. Do you think he intuitively understood this? Do you think he, you know, he obviously wasn't a psychiatrist or a psychologist by training. How do you think he kind of figured this out?
So there seems to be sort of several key things he's doing, which he never describes in one document. You've got to remember, this is the Second World War. They are in the war of survival. So we do have lots of notes that he's writing to his superiors explaining what he's doing. He had to defend every one of his editorial decisions. But if you put them together, plus this transcript, plus his memoirs, you get a sense of what the plan was. They didn't have, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, they're working at pace. They didn't have time for theory. But there is a, I think there's yes, a real pattern there. And an intentional one, not an accidental one. The first one is you've got to break the kind of the monopoly that the bad guys have on strong emotion. You know, it wasn't, you know, his shows are full of passion, invective, jealousy, anger, sex. You can't allow the Nazis to occupy that space. You've got to get into that territory to start owning it. The second one, you're quite right. You've got to, it's not, you know, people don't care about facts if they don't relate to who they are. You've got to get people the right facts, the facts that matter to them, which is, you know, what diseases are in your food? Has your, you know, immediate superior stolen all the best food reserves and giving you the old ones? And they would get real information through really quite spectacular means. What's happening with your weapons? Why aren't they working well? You know, those kind of details that relate to your survival, which make you go, my God, it's not even that the Nazis are lying to me. It's just this truth is relevant to me. While the Nazis are talking about, you know, the glorious future of the fatherland, these guys are telling me whether my tinned salmon is going to give me, you know, some horrible disease. So giving people facts that really matter to them and bringing them into your kind of like, you know, your circle of knowledge. But then he was always thinking about identity. So he was always stressing the other identities that Germans had that weren't the Nazi identity. The Nazis were trying to impose an identity of one they created about the people. You were part of the group, the Nazi group. He was stressing your religious affiliations, your affiliations in the army, your affiliations to your region. So he was always thinking about what are the other group identities. And finally, so we've gone through strong emotions, you know, break the Nazi hold on strong emotions, give people the facts that really matter to them to make them trust you, because it's important to their survival. Number three, group identities that are alternative to the identities that the Nazis give. And the final one, which actually I think is the most important one, is make people feel they have agency. So Delmer is constantly giving people information that is stimulating them to act in their own self-interest, not in the interest of the Nazis. So whether that is teaching people how to fake diseases to defect from the front, or giving people information about the rights they have when they get injured. You know, what can you now do? You've been injured. What can you now do in order to take back control and get away from the front? And so on and so forth. Just the very act of tuning into a radio where you were kind of pretending to be, you know, pretending you were listening to a Nazi station, which you knew was a British station, and the British know, you know, even that act is already a very kind of, you know, you're involved psychologically in an act of kind of creation and searching and curiosity and self-reinvention. While the Nazis wanted you to be passive, they wanted you to sit back and be kind of like awash in, you know, the ecstasy of being part of the Nazi people. And you were meant to sort of sublimate all your agency to the leader. The leader decides, the party decides, you just follow and sacrifice yourself. So he's always trying to stimulate people to start acting and thinking for themselves. So if you put all those things together, I think you have a really powerful package. And look, I study propaganda and disinformation today. I think we need media that start pushing all those elements together. Because if you think about it, people are all doing different things like that, but no one's put them together into a package that would really be able to compete with the Putins or the Xi Jinping's or again, I always feel so awkward talking about American politics as a foreigner here, but maybe you can apply it within America as well.
Yeah, yes. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. I just want to pick up on one thing that you mentioned, which is the ability to relate to facts. When the Nazis were winning, the Nazi propaganda was closer to reality. When they kept insisting they were winning, and the bombs keep falling on the Germans, there was an aperture that opened so that they could be told, well, of course you're not winning. What else are you being lied about to? So there is a point at which are greater opportunities for truth-telling when bodies start coming back, when bombs keep falling. So there is a reality eventually that you come up against that even propaganda can't cover up. And it seems that Delmer was very successful in kind of just picking at that, aggravating that, you know, like a scratch. Really? You know, they say they're, you know, success, but then why are the bombs falling? Why are the, you know, people coming home? That seemed to have been a very powerful part of, and a weakness of propaganda, that when it departs from reality, there's this gap that other people can fill with reality.
Yeah, but the Nazis were playing with that. I mean, you know, Goebbels, who is sort of the other hero of my book, or anti-hero. I'm always moving in the book between what Delmer's doing, what Goebbels is doing. I mean, so when the bombs start falling on Berlin, Goebbels tries to deny it. No, like which bombs, you know, because it makes Nazi Germany look weak. Then he switches it around. Then he starts going, well, look at this horrible atrocities. Look at these damn British. He tries to use it to get people to hate the enemy. So Goebbels from 43, actually, the same kind of time, Goebbels switches to what he calls a sort of, I can't remember if he calls it or it's called that way, sort of a propaganda of gloom. Yes, everything's bad, but we're going to get through it because we're on a great mission. So Goebbels is adapting as well. He realizes really quickly that, you know, that gap is very easily exploitable. So he tries to make up for it and spin it his own way. So it's a game. They're constantly competing. But yes, obviously, Delmer is always trying to bring back the kind of like the negative reality that the Nazis are bringing. But he, you know, that's not enough. He's also trying to get people to start doing things as well. They're not just meant to sort of start getting turned off by the Nazi mission. They're meant to start defecting more. They're meant to start not contributing to Nazi marches. They're meant to start not taking part in the Nazi economy. That's a really important thing. Obviously, there's no voting there. But if there were elections, he'd be sort of saying, okay, you didn't like them, so go vote for the other side. So he's not, you know, he's going beyond just pointing out the sort of the gaps in Nazi propaganda. He wants people to actually start defecting if you're a soldier, but also defecting from the whole project.
And when it simply becomes a death cult, when towards the end of the war, the Nazis are saying, you know, the best thing is a glorious death. He's saying, well, here's how you get out of the dying. Here's how you get sent back. And that was just perfect because obviously there's a survival instinct that people were looking for. You mean I have to die? No, you don't have to die. You can survive this. And here's how you do it. And that seemed to be the perfect kind of counter-programming to what the Nazis were trying to do, which was almost a mass suicide.
Yes, which by the way, might be sometimes more attractive than we think. You know, the sort of like the sort of pushing people towards sort of obliteration might have some weird allure. It's a very uncomfortable notion, but you know, look at what's happening right now in the war in Ukraine. I mean, when the war started, there was a real belief among the Ukrainian army and among Ukraine supporters here that Russia would stop because its losses were so high. And yet the losses in Russia now are bigger. The Russian losses are bigger than I think all Russia's wars between the end of the Second World War and now.
Yes.
It's catastrophic numbers. And yet they keep on going. Now, they're going for many reasons. They're going for financial reasons. They're going because they don't feel there's a choice. I mean, I'm not saying they're going there because they're enjoying dying, but they keep on going. And our kind of original theory that was that, you know, Putin would have to stop when he would see the amount of deaths. And yet society seems to accept it. And yet soldiers seem to accept it. They acquiesce to it. Even if, like, you know, I very much doubt they're actively enjoying it. So what do you do about that? You know, what do you do with an enemy that is so relentless in its appetite for self-destruction? So Delmer's working with something very, very complicated. And look, you know, we've got to remember that even though the tide had turned in the war in 43-44, there was still plenty of opportunities for the Germans not to lose it fully. You know, there were still choices being made all the way through. I mean, Delmer was always very honest that you know, the role of propaganda in war is always going to be secondary or tertiary to what happens in the military space. So if there hadn't been military victories, if the Nazis had carried on winning, then any amount of propaganda would never have been able to solve that.
All right. So let's have a little fun, if we can call it fun. What kind of program would Delmer put together to beam into the Soviet Union, or the, I call the Soviet Union because it really is at this point, to the Russian population? What would, what characters would he create, or what sore points would he aggravate?
So, I mean, I have to confess, this is what I do in my spare time. I started thinking what he would do. So I think tomorrow, the figure that always struck me was 40% of German soldiers tuning into Delmer's programs. This is based on these very small polls that the British did of German POWs. So if we could get 40% of Russian soldiers listening to our broadcast, which, believe me, they don't do at the moment with, the BBC or Voice of America, God bless them, but they're not that popular, that would be a success. So how would we do that? So tomorrow we would want Russian forces from Syria all the way through eastern Ukraine, southern Russia, maybe even up to the northwest where they have huge garrisons. We would want them to wake up to a multimedia project. It wouldn't just be radio. It had to be everything now, You need to combine things. I think we would stick to this idea of something that gives them an excuse to say, oh, I think I'm listening to Putin radio. Call it Radio Zvezda, which is the official state forces radio, but it's clearly being really subversive. And the first thing you would target would be, the divisions between soldiers and their immediate higher-ups. I mean, everyone knows in Russia that Putin's corrupt. It's too far away. It's meaningless that Putin's corrupt. You want the corruption of your neighbor. You want the corruption of the guy just above you. And look, unlike Delmer, who had to go to extraordinary lengths to get this evidence, it's so much easier now. There's, very friendly Russian hackers who are constantly getting information, but they get it about the higher ups. I want to know, I want to get, stuff about the medium officer, the medium level party official that people can actually see and already feel resentful about. So you want all that sort of information about their mid-level corruption. No, look, the aim is not to get people to be outraged and go, stop this corruption. We're not anti-corruption activists. When Delmer was doing material about the corruption of mid-level Nazi officials, he didn't want people to be appalled and then to rebel against them. He wanted people to go, well, hold on, if they're corrupt, then I'm going to be corrupt. He wants to encourage corruption. Over and over again, corruption has saved Ukraine. Russian corruption, not Ukrainian corruption, Russian corruption has saved Ukraine. It was because Putin's system is so corrupt that the initial invasion was botched. We want to encourage more corruption. Yeah? We want ordinary soldiers to say, well, I'm not going to go and fight if my immediate higher up is avoiding fighting. So that sort of stuff. But also, you want to be giving them incredibly good information about their crappy new Chinese weapons. Yeah, because they're getting more and more spare parts from China, which don't work as well, which explode in their faces. So you have to give them really, 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 detailed and accurate information about how their weapons are going wrong. So every time they pick up sort of these trashy Chinese substitute arms or North Korean arms, they start getting very, very nervous because they understand these aren't working well. You want to be giving loads of information about how when they die, because a lot of them are just fighting for money now, the payments won't get through to their relatives, which is a really big scandal for a lot of soldiers. We know that by by just reading the sort of stuff they're posting on social media. They've all been promised that if they die, their relatives are going to get loads of money. What the Russian state does is not register their deaths, or saying, we don't know what happened to this person, as a way of avoiding that. So you want to be surfacing all these really, really genuine gripes that they have. You definitely don't want to be talking down to them. You don't want to be lecturing them. You want to be surfacing all this stuff. But you want to be doing it in such a way that it makes their higher-ups start thinking, okay, who's leaking this information, to get them fighting among one another. You want to do it in a way that is encouraging defections, encouraging them to fight better, and decreasing mobilization even further, to start slowing down the machine. To the point where the higher ups in the Russian system start going, well, are we really in control? Are we managing this? And should we start thinking about adapting our foreign policy because our military effort is not sustainable? So that's the sort of thing you would be planning there. And it's kind of, I think it's a no-brainer. Then, of course, you know, Delmer was timing very specific campaigns around specific bits of the war. I mean, that is the overall, you know, the overall picture of what you're doing. And then you're timing very specific campaigns to do with very specific battles. That's the content. Then there's the tone of it. Look, we already have examples. You know, you had the Prigozhin Rebellion a year ago, when this far right, more nationalist than Putin mercenary leader, Prigozhin, essentially started, you know, rebelling against the army higher ups. I mean, he rarely criticized Putin. His argument was that his mercenary army was fighting better in Ukraine than the official army, and that we should get rid of the army higher ups. And he was, in a way, more nationalistic than the regular army, even more racist, even more imperialist. But from that position, that was a legitimate place in order to criticize the official army system. Again, maybe you would be thinking about sort of tapping in to some of that fervor, some of that emotion. Delmer certainly would have. So that's the sort of way you would go. You've got to remember, you know, the Russian soldiers would know perfectly well this was the Ukrainians with the help of, I don't know, their allies who were doing this. But you want Russian soldiers to go, oh my God, they understand our lives so well. They understand the details of our weapons so well. They understand like how awful our food is so well. They understand the reality of relatives not getting paid for death so well that these guys are really good. You know, do we really want to be loyal to a system that doesn't understand us? Or do we want to start questioning that? So that's how you'd approach it. And I think the Ukrainians would love to be doing it, is my sense. But it takes, you know, the lesson from Delmer is it takes huge resources to do this. To do crappy disinformation campaigns on a Twitter handle is easy. That's not what you do. You actually have to know more about people's lives than regular journalists do. You've got to do more research than regular journalism does to be that vital. And it takes large resources. It's a lot easier today than it was in Delmer's time. It's so much easier to get information than then. But it takes vast resources. And of course, the Ukrainians are having to pick up the dead bodies of children with cancer from a hospital the Russians just bombed. They don't have the resources you need to launch something like this. Yeah. Sorry, I clearly think about this way too much. you know, I like saying that.
I know, no. This was fabulous.
This is, well, yes. Well, I'm going to do something. I mean, DC traffic is terrible. So as I sit through DC traffic, you know, this is what I think.
Yes. Well, I took a gamble there that you would have thought about this and have a game plan. Boy, did you. One of the things that's somewhat tragic about Delmer is he kind of loses himself in all of this and wonders, he constantly wonders, am I a good guy? Am I a good bad guy? Am I one of the bad guys? At the end of his life, what do you think he thought of his venture? And did he have some sense of satisfaction that he had been a clever good guy? Or did he ultimately come away kind of demoralized by the whole experience?
So Delmer's always playing. He's a man of masks. And you know, that's why, you know, it was so fascinating writing about him. So the position in his memoirs was, because his memoirs are a weird morality tale. You know, he revels in telling the story of his cleverness, of his tricks. He's called them his tricks. And then he says, but at the end, there was a horrible payback. And he talks about Germany after the war, and where he feels that his radios created this idea that there was a split between the Nazis and the German military. And that allowed senior members of the German military, who had always been Nazis deep down, to return into power and to take very senior positions in the new administration and business and in the security services. And he gets really worried that a new form of German authoritarianism is emerging. Now, you've got to remember, he'd seen that happen after the First World War. So he had, you know, his fears were not, you know, paranoid. And he becomes one of the leading advocates of people saying that there's a real, you know, a real danger that Germany is going to go authoritarian again. By the 19, and he thought it was partly his fault. He thought he'd created this myth of the good German soldier, or at least the non-Nazi German soldier, which was then used as an excuse. In a way, of course, he's slightly praising himself as he does so, because he's saying, my influence was so vast that I let this bad thing happen. So Delman never stops playing. You know, he's always playing and playing and playing. There's always a twinkle in his eye. There's always a new mask that he's pulling off. So did he feel that he hadn't achieved, you know, everything he'd hoped for? I mean, we've got to remember he was also a really successful journalist and carried on being that for a couple of decades after the war. So he went back to being a journalist. He was one of the first people to be knighted in Britain for his he got an OBE for his deeds in the war, which was you know, definitely a celebration of what he'd done in the war. He did publish his memoirs again during his lifetime. He was very, very well known. So I don't think he felt ignored. Did he feel satisfied? You know, he had a, you know, his obituaries when he died, they were very generous. They talked about a genius. That word was often used about him, who had this incredible gift of understanding the enemy. I mean, there was a, you know, there was, in different sort of like biographies that were written about him or about the work more than about him. I mean, they really bring that out, that his, what made him special and different to all the other people working on British communication in the war was his ability to penetrate into the mind of the enemy. Oh, hello. We lost Riverside.
Yes. Oh. There we are. We're back.
So he was, sorry, I hope that wasn't right. So look, he was recognized as having a special gift, as being, you know, having a unique talent, and in that sense, and in the circle of people who think about propaganda, he is seen as a guru, but sometimes by the worst people. So the head of the East German sort of disinformation unit would give Delmer's memoirs to everyone, saying this is the way you do subterfuge. So the bad guys loved his ideas too, which is another example of his ideas being used by, you know, for evil ends. But yes, I suppose what happened as history moved on was his ideas were forgotten, especially after his death, when he wasn't around to sort of tell the story anymore. And his son gives a really interesting interview to British TV in the 90s, saying the British didn't want to remember this bit of the war because, you know, it does talk about disinformation. Delmer was, you know, creating fake radio stations that played to some of the nastiest and meanest emotions and that used pornography and racist rhetoric, frankly. And the British didn't want to think about that. It was meant to be, you know, our finest hour that brought out our finest virtues, our most noble feelings. And nobody wanted to talk about these kind of pirates of propaganda that were doing all these devious and naughty things. And so, you know, Britain's a country that does like to dwell on its victory in World War II. This is one of the chapters that the British decided not to dwell on as a society. I mean, no one ever censored it. It was kind of society didn't want to think about it. I'd like to think that we can get over that now. Enough time has passed for us, A, to be honest about everything we did in the war. We did some truly horrific things like firebombing Dresden. You know, this was, you know, compared to, you know, sort of mass bombardments of civilians, this was pretty harmless stuff. But also, again, what I found so fascinating about Delmer was that even if he started his work thinking that he was doing, there's no way of sugarcoating this, of disinformation. That's what it is. Deceiving his audience. It gets interesting when he realizes that that is actually not the way to do it. That actually you've got to engage your listeners in a way that is actually quite honest. I mean, you're not hiding who you are. You are openly saying, look, I am British. I'm trying to win the war. I am not just your culture, your enemy in a culture war. I'm your enemy in a real war. But I'm now going to create content that is so engaging for you that it's going to make you defect from your fascist leaders.
And that, I think, was the ultimate house of mirrors, that he wound up doing honest propaganda in some sense.
Yeah.
Are you working on another book? Because I am dying to read more of these sorts of things. Are you working mostly in the academic area, or are you going to do another popular book for the general public?
I'm The book's just come out. So I'm in that phase where I don't know whether you go through this or...
Yes.
But where like, I'm like, I will never write again, which is a bit like after a big night of drinking, you're like, you will never drink again. I'm sure I will do the next book, but at the moment I'm in that post-book phase, looking forward to be doing a bunch of journalism as about the war and about the election. I'm very involved with a project called The Reckoning Project, which documents war crimes in Ukraine and then does media about it. So sort of doing a lot of quite heavy, but I hope important writing and editing and media work around getting people to understand really what the Russians are up to in Ukraine, because it's you know, we see the pictures of bombed hospitals and we see these horrific stories of torture, but they're doing something much bigger than that, which I think is getting lost, which is they're trying to do this sort of an experiment from the mid-20th century that the Nazis would understand or the Soviets, which is essentially obliterate the idea of a country and then socially engineer a new identity onto Ukrainians, an enforced re-education. It's to kill them and then take the remaining ones and break their identity and force them on pain of death to become these kind of little Russians or you know, like Ukrainians who are just a subset of Russians. It's this huge kind of enforced re-education and enforced indoctrination process that they're doing, which I think, you know, if you look at the history of the 20th century, this is what totalitarian regimes do. They will take a whole country, a whole nation, a whole people, and try to break them into something else. And I think we've forgotten that countries do that. I mean, that's what Mao did, what Stalin did, obviously what Hitler was trying to do. And that's what the Russians are doing. And I think sometimes we miss this bigger picture. It's not just like, you know, all wars are full of horrific war crimes, and Russia's way of war has always been to obliterate hospitals and schools as a way to break, you know, the population. It's always been their theory of war. They did it in Syria. They did it in Chechnya. It's just how they approach conflict. But they're doing something even, I think, more malign than that, which is essentially change who people are in a way that is in the tradition of the worst parts of the 20th century. And I do want to help people understand that.
Well, I cannot recommend the book enough. I must say, I was alternately eyes popping out of my head, laughing uproariously, and very, very worried that the brilliance of Delmer might be lost, frankly, on our current intelligence agency. But that's for another day. Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you for the book, which is fascinating. Thank you for coming on the show and explaining it to us. And absolute good luck in, I don't know if you can call it luck, but good wishes in the important work you're doing on Ukraine and Russia.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure having you be so interested in the book. Thank you.
And that was Peter Pomerantsev. Wow, a lot of good and interesting information there. And what I come away with is we have to put ourselves not in the shoes of people who are rational, who are subject to reason, who will be persuaded by facts, but people who are part of a right-wing cult. And we have to think about ways in which we can lessen their attachment to their cult leader, or at least discourage some people from joining the cult, or people who are on the verge of joining the cult. We need to wean them away from that, to remind them that they have agency over themselves, to make them aware of the weaknesses, the insanity of their leader, and to help them to separate their natural patriotism from their fidelity to this maniacal figure. And I think rather than writing people off in their entirety, I think it's worthwhile to adopt some of the techniques that Peter gave us, because after all, whichever way the election comes out, we're going to have to live with our fellow Americans. So it pays to begin to make some entrees. And if, God forbid, Donald Trump is elected, we're going to need to mount a resistance to beat all resistances. And we're going to need some of those people. We're going to need those people to recognize that they made a terrible error and that they've put in place someone who is very dangerous. So I think making a rational appeal works with our rational friends, with many independents. Making rational appeals to Democrats, who may be a little bit, I don't know, discouraged these days, that makes sense. But for those people who are already within the cult, we have to be creative and we have to think of ways that we can reach them and, frankly, restore them to American political democratic society, because right now that's not where they are. So, a lot to think about. If you enjoyed this program and you enjoyed our other programs, please tell your friends. They can listen and follow us on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever they get their podcasts. Bye-bye.